Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I am Aaron.
And today we're here to talk about Season 3, Episode 3, titled Walk of Punishment. I think we all know what that reference is.
Walk of Punishment?
No.
That's what this episode was.
Not for those slaves.
No, God no. Again, very grim dark.
Yeah. Yeah. Grisly stuff. What do you think of this episode overall?
Grizzly, is that a crack on the bear in the maiden fair?
A little hairier. That guy was pretty hairy.
I forgot how much shit happens this season. Like, that's the thing about this show that, like, hooks people is that, like, Jaime getting his sword arm whopped off came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Just as they get you kind of excited for, like, maybe the return of Jaime Lannister, badass warrior. Like, oh, okay, he got beat by Brienne, but, you know, he's been in the mud and chained and is weak and famished and blah, blah, blah. Nope, done. Sword arm, gone.
Yeah, and this is, you know, why last episode I was lamenting, oh, man, I really want to see the Jaime we've heard about, you know, the excellent sword fighter with finesse and grace, and I guess we're not going to get that without a sword hand.
No. I mean, you know, we'll have to see how that, but that's a huge transformation that came out of nowhere of the character, for the character. And do you remember the first time you saw this episode? Like, did you see the danger that Jaime was stepping into, or did you buy, I forget what this guy's name is, Roose Bolton's hunter, or did you buy the fact that he was just, like, being persuaded to be nice to Jaime because of the rewards and riches?
I think I bought it.
Yeah?
I think I bought it. The guy plays it like he's buying into it, mostly.
Right. And then when he puts him in his place, I'm like, okay. But then, like, just the sudden savagery of the arm chop is like, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And then it goes, then if you weren't off balance enough, it smash cuts right into this metal version of the Bear and the Maiden Fair.
I remember actually hating that.
Did you?
Yeah. I hated this song in that moment.
What did you think I don't know. I find it grimly funny.
It is. I don't know that I wanted funny in that moment, though. Like, this is the biggest development in Jamie's life heretofore, and I just don't think it worked.
Have you seen the meme of, like, where they play a broken recorder version of My Heart Will Go On during, like, the opposite of an epic moment in, like, a video game or something? Like,
no, but I can imagine that really ruins it.
Or they'll do the broken recorder version of the Jurassic Park theme on something that's majestic, but it's not. It should be majestic, but it's shitty.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like we needed a smash cut, the broken recorder version of The Reigns of Castamere. Just, like, off key and hesitant and nerdy, because that's how it felt like, you know. You thought Jaime was going to get back, you know, everything was going to turn him back up Jaime Lannister, and then slip, slop, chop, he's done.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you give your opinion on the episode?
No, I really enjoyed it. I mean, there is just so much good stuff in here, from the small council meeting to Podrick and his abilities, let's call them. All of it is so good. And the Edmure stuff, like...
It's uncommonly funny episode, too.
It is, yeah.
And they do such a great job of establishing, like, the Blackfish.
Yeah.
And in contrast, Edmure. A lot of that, like, I think they've really amped up the contrast of those characters from the books. But it works. And, like, you got to go with shorthand, and you got to kind of turn the characters into more archetypes, and... Mm. That Viking funeral scene that almost wasn't is a great way to do it.
And I think, you know, having that right on, or having the Rob scene where he chastises Edmure,
right,
for his impatience, essentially, and for mucking up his entire strategy, does a lot of good for Rob's character and further humiliates Edmure, which I found enjoyable. But Rob, you know, he's had moments of strategic thinking, but they've never really explained, I guess, so much what's going on in his head, but here they really get inside of it, and we understand his strategy a little more intimately, and I think that's important for that character, because I need to look at Rob and say he is the strategic equal of Tywin.
Right.
And this scene especially helped me really believe that.
Yeah. Or that he's close enough that maybe passion and ferocity could overcome, because I don't think he can outfight I don't think he can outthink or outfight Tywin, but I do think his men are more motivated.
Well, the stuff that Barristan talks about later in the episode, right?
Right.
The men he the knows and fought for love respect, and respect. And
whereas Tywin's guys are honor. Probably fighting for gold.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Those scenes are really good, and there's just so much else that's awesome. And then the ending, of course, is shocking in a really good way.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it.
We should get into it then.
Okay, let's do it.
A little bit of housekeeping before we get going into the episode. We just want to remind everybody we're also watching the miniseries Sharp Objects on HBO. We are releasing those on Tuesday afternoon in the Bald Move TV feed. We're also doing some general TV discussion. We went through the Emmy nominations for 2018. What else? We did some
talked
other...
about Stranger Things. Yeah, new trailer.
Talked about the new season teaser trailer, which is pretty good. Check that out in the Bald Move TV feed because that'll be going on for another 6 weeks. Also, Better Call Saul season 4 is starting early in August. We're going to have our preview out Wednesday, August the 1st, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you'd like to send feedback to that, talk about your hopes and fears and whatever for season 4, you can do that at bettercastsaul@baldmove.com. First run Bald Movies are still going strong. We did Skyscraper last week. This week I saw Mamma Mia 2 with Cecily, and we're also going to be doing Mission Impossible 2 this Friday. We usually see it on Thursday night, but because we're traveling, we're going to be a day late. We're going to get that out hopefully late Friday afternoon. So we're going to be seeing... What did I say Mission Impossible 2?
You did. I don't know what
it's Mission
called.
Impossible 10, maybe 11, Fallout. That's the one we're seeing.
Okay.
Also, another programming note, we moved our TV, our Twitch.tv streams from Monday and Wednesday to Tuesday and Thursday at 4 p.m. Just for the summer, the better suit our schedule. Finally, a couple weeks left in the book.baldmove.com campaign, the religious book that I'm writing with Anthony LaDon, a religious scholar, about the religions of Westeros and Essos. Still some time to get some really cool rewards and merch and help us make the book as big and awesome as we can. Check out that Kickstarter at book.baldmove.com. That will be out in November in time for Christmas. So if you want a hard copy of the book, your only sure way to get it is on the Kickstarter, book.baldmove.com. Thanks in advance for your support.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, we start off with Catelyn's father given a northern or Viking funeral. I can't tell if this is this just a Tully thing or is this a northern kind of thing?
No, it's a Tully thing. Okay. Kind of like the river. Like this, the trident runs right through the castle and becomes like its primary, you know, one of its primary strengths, the fact that it's got a ready source of fresh water and food in the forms of fish. And, you know, they can drop these portcullises down so no one can get inside, but they still can enjoy that. And what are you going to do, poison the whole river?
Right.
Maybe. We'll see.
Divert the whole river,
yeah,
maybe?
Divert the whole, like, do a Nebuchadnezzar or, well, that was Osiris the Great on Nebuchadnezzar. But it's, yeah, like, the river is a big thing for them. This is kind of a way to, like, return things. And but I always wondered, like, is there, like, anytime you hear, like, a great lord dying in Riverrun, are there, like, peasants like just around the river bend ready to, like, douse the flames and pillage the corpse, like, hey, he's got a gold ring on, and that sword's Castleford steel and whatnot.
A lot of fishermen out that day their boats,
right? Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, trying to catch a Tully fish.
He's given a funeral here. Edmure attempts three times to shoot the boat with the arrow and fails. So his uncle steps in and does a job for him.
Boat almost got out of range.
Even of the Blackfish, yeah.
Yeah. I did like how they really had him pull deep and aim high and, like, account for the wind. But then once he did, he just didn't,
yeah, he
didn't
saw
have
it.
To look. Here's your bow, kid.
He knew. And just the looks that happened between Edmure and Catelyn, and Rob is back there trying not to laugh at how ridiculous all of this is. I really love that scene.
But he shows a contrast. You don't even know, like, the backstory to Blackfish is that he is, like, one of the most accomplished warriors in the Seventh Kingdom. Like, he's been in, they describe 50 battles, which is, like, fucking George Martin's favorite way to say a buttload. Uh-huh. And, you know, he's, like, just, like, distinguished and renowned warrior, and, like, the fact that Edmure is probably, you know, he was raised in the summer, and he was probably too young to really fight in rebellion, and largely untested, and this kind of, like, I couldn't, you know, like, someone asked me to shoot my dad's funeral boat, and I get and it's going down river and getting further away all the time, I'd choke.
There's so much pressure.
Yeah, I mean, how much do you practice that? Whereas the Blackfish is just like, you know, I've killed men like this. They're trying to kill me back.
Right.
With arrows, like, no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great way to show all the tension here so that the next scene doesn't come out of nowhere.
Right. The utterly withering attack on Edmure continues in this next scene, where Rob chastises him for driving the mountain out of the territory in the opposite direction of where Rob wanted him to go. And he knows that being impatient is not a trait that Tywin shares.
Right.
And that's a very dangerous thing. I really feel like Rob is a king here, you know? I mean, I don't know what it is about Edmure's face, but I want to see him humiliated.
Right. I mean, he does. He looks like a dandy.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
He looks like a guy who hasn't paid the iron price for shit. And in this world, you kind of need to pay the iron price for a little. I mean, you don't have to be full Iron Islanders about it, but
I did think maybe Blackfish got a little too much pleasure from the dressing down of Edmure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially when Rob's like, oh, we captured two 14-year-old boys, and he's actually like, oh, I think Martin is 15.
Right, right. And yeah, I mean, it just shows the. But on the other hand, maybe Rob could have sent this guy Raven and said, "Hey, here's the plan," because his plan was to get the Mountain's blood up and have him follow, you know, over pursue and get enmeshed, and then they would, you know, envelop him, and that would be all over. But Edmure, you know, as a guy who's been largely untested and a bit of a dandy, he was really eager to distinguish himself by taking this mill. And, you know, but he's just not thinking. And Rob just, and also the fact that they lost 208 men, and him saying, we need our men more than Tywin does, because now Tywin's got this fresh infusion from Highgarden, and now Rob doesn't have the advantage in men or gold. It's pretty great. You're right. It made Rob look kingly. Also, the fact that Blackfish, as established in the beginning, is such a badass. And again, you don't know his full backstory, but you just get what a serious fellow this is and how competent he is. And he's calling this guy his king. And he's way ahead of his nephew in terms of realizing the depths of the tactical blunder that he made. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I totally agree. It made Rob look regal and serious, which he kind of needed, because the story for several episodes has been him letting his dick lead him around and getting him in trouble.
Yeah, good to see that there's more to him than that.
Yeah.
Then we go over to Tywin's.
By the way, the smash cut to this scene from the last of Tywin. Tywin's not losing his patience, and we see this farce of a small council meeting.
And Tywin very much keeping his patience about him.
but it's a trial. He's got his share of clowns, too.
Absolutely, yeah. So Tywin's council shows up for the meeting they're having, and his council is made up of Varys, Littlefinger, Pycelle, Tyrion, and Cersei. Tywin wants to know why they haven't found Jaime yet, even with all of their, you know, much storied spy networks. He decides that Littlefinger will marry Lady Arryn, becoming Lord of the Vale as well as Lord of Harrenhal, and Littlefinger doesn't object. Tyrion objects that they will be without a Master of Coin, so Tywin gives Tyrion the title.
Tyrion sees the danger here, because I don't think Tyrion would balk at becoming the Master of Coin in any other circumstance, but he suspects that Littlefinger has been cooking the books and doing a whole bunch of leveraging the kingdom, and we know that's exactly what he's been doing. He hasn't been magically making money. He's been borrowing heavily to feed, King Robert's appetites. And now it seems like King Joffrey's even got a bigger appetite, because they're talking about the wedding being the most expensive event in human history. And the summer's ending and there's hard days ahead, and the crown's broke. Yeah. Not great. But meanwhile, Littlefinger, like Tyrion bled for this kingdom, almost died. Littlefinger gets Harrenhal. And if he wins the hand of Lysa Arryn, becomes Lord of the Vale. Two of the most prestigious and important holdings in all of Westeros. Because Harrenhal's got the reputation for being cursed, but his lands are very wealthy. Gotcha. It generates a lot of the castle itself. Nobody wants to live there because it's haunted and whatnot. But the lands it belongs to are one of the more productive and wealthy of the kingdom. So it's a nice plum to get. And Cersei just gave it to Sir, what's his face? Who is the guy who's Tyrion? He didn't question his loyalty. He denied it or didn't question his honor. He just denied it entirely. Janos Slynt, yes, that guy.
The guy who used to be, who was in Bronn's position,
right?
Before Tyrion got hand
the captain of the Gold Cloaks.
Yeah,
so great. And I like the goons kind of jockeying for position.
No, this is an amazingly written scene. Every character is doing exactly what you would expect of them. Like when Littlefinger ducks in to the front of the pack,
elbows
next to Tywin.
Varys,
and then Varys just elbowing back with his words, you know, really just digging the knife into Littlefinger with this Lord of Harrenhal stuff, you know, and how important he views titles, and he doesn't, you know, all he has is the title at the moment.
Right.
He doesn't have the actual castle.
Right.
I love it.
And Cersei dragging hers to her father's right hand, of course. Mm-hmm. So she's feeling smug. And Tyrion's just puts it at the heat. But opposite of his father, like there's a struggle, which is head, which is the foot. And he makes the whole it's a lovely table, intimate. It's great. It's great.
Yeah. I do see this arrangement, let's call it, between Littlefinger and Lady Arryn as Tywin trying to remove potential allies from Robb's board and add them to his own.
I mean, that's a tradition. I mean, that was the Northern Riverland Vale Alliance was the old Rebel Alliance. So if you can split one third of that off,
and I think this
you'd
is
be
a,
well to do so.
This is probably a good time to do it because I'm Lady Arryn is Catelyn's sister,
right?
And Catelyn has been branded a traitor, a treasonous at the moment. I think you might be able to seize upon that and turn her loyalties against Robb, Lady Arryn's loyalties against Robb, in order to maybe take him down and save her sister.
Right.
Something like that. I wonder if that's what's going through Tywin's head.
Yeah, and also that the Vale is one of the last places that has a large unbloodied army. Like, they haven't done any scuffling because Lyza's been paranoid ever since the stuff with Jon Arryn happened, or at least that was her pretense. So there is, if you can win her, you've got another fresh source of troops that are pretty, you know, Knights of the Vale are pretty highly regarded. Mm-hmm. So it's a win-win for Tywin.
So then we go over to Brienne and Jaime, captive. They're being transported to wherever Robb is, or I guess wherever he's going to meet them, because I doubt he's staying in River Run very long. They argue about who would have won the battle if it had continued or if Jaime hadn't been bound. It's just kind of some ribbing here. But then it turns a little dark when he says that Brienne shouldn't resist when they come to rape her later, lest she be killed. Jaime kind of being very pragmatic here. Brienne understandably being less so. I did notice that they're singing a new song here.
The Bear.
The Bear and the Maiden Fair.
There's two songs from Westeros. Reigns of Castamere and The Bear and the Maiden Fair.
Who... Is Brienne the Bear and Jaime's the Maiden Fair? I feel like in this scenario, maybe so.
Could be. Could be.
Yeah. Fancy words for a fancy lad.
But I think the quote of the scene is when she says, "Is you know, just don't resist and do what they want. Close your eyes, pretend it's Renly." She's like, "Oh, is that what you do for your woman? And he goes, "No, I'd make them kill me, but I'm not, thank the gods."
Right.
So... yeah. It's pretty dark.
It is, yeah. And it's meant to be. But it's a good scene. Then we move on to Arya, who is not quite a prisoner of Thoros, but it certainly feels like it to her. The Hound is being loaded into a wagon and carted off somewhere. And then Hot Pie apparently has been traded for all the free meals that the inn has been giving to Thoros men because he's such a good baker. And he gives Arya a wolf-shaped loaf of bread as they all say their goodbyes and part ways.
Wolf-shaped?
Hey, man, I think this is a really good wolf,
given
the tools at his disposal.
He even did the fur. He even did the rippling fur.
He's got some cross-hatching. It's good.
Yeah, like, you couldn't do better, Arya. Come on.
Hell no.
it's a neat little scene. Like, Arya... I like Arya being kind of dismayed that the Gendry's helping the Brotherhood, and you know she tries to get a goat out of the Hound because I think she's trying to remind him about the butcher boy that he rode down, for petty revenge for Joffrey, and then Hot Pie abandons her. I'm not a Stark of Winterhell. it's so funny, and then. When they part, I think that was pretty cute. And then Arya coming and, you know, saying she's chewing the head off the wolf and saying it's really good. I thought it's a nice little goodbye scene.
It is. Yeah. I felt like she needed to have that final moment of saying, hey, it might not look good. I might've had a weird reaction when I saw it, but it tastes good.
Right.
You're a good baker. Bye, Hot Pie.
Yeah. Hope you stay safe in this little inn on the King's Road.
Yeah. Then we move on to Catelyn and the Blackfish, talking about her father and his brother. Hoster is the guy's name who died.
Yep.
Hoster and the Blackfish had some 30-year feud going on, but Hoster couldn't even remember why they were fighting about it last they spoke. Catelyn remembers being young and waiting for Hoster to return from battles and just all sorts of trips, which makes her wonder if her children did the same with her or currently are. When she breaks down at the thought of her dead children, Blackfish tells her that she has to remain strong for Robb.
Because he has to keep hope alive for his brothers so that he can keep going on.
Yep.
It's another incredible scene. And again, you don't, the backstory here for Brendan the Blackfish is that him and Hoster never saw eye to eye. Like, Hoster was the oldest, and he took over River Run when their father died. But then he always was trying, because, you know, Brendan was a catch. The Blackfish was a catch, and he was trying to marry him off to do different alliances. And Brendan's like, nah, I'm not marrying her. I'm not going to marry her.
Huh.
And then during the rebellion, when John Aaron married Liza to cement the two houses during the rebellion, the Blackfish actually left to go serve the Aaron. He was the captain of the Bloody Gates, the first kind of fortification on the way to the Erie, which Hoster interpreted as kind of like abandoning his family, and he kind of disowned him. And that how he got the name is they were having a heated family argument, and Hoster said, "You're just a black goat of the family," which I think is the Westerosi version of the saying, "You're the black sheep." And then Brendan pointed out that, well, we're fish in this house, so if anything, I'd be a black fish. And then he made that his personal sigil just to kind of rub it in. So just... Hmm. They've had a really prickly relate, and it seems like it's very much a both sides situation.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think Hoster made any effort to understand. I don't know why Brendan, like, whether he just likes to fight and go out there, didn't want to be tied down to a woman. Shit, maybe he's gay. But there's just a lot of, like, misunderstandings and failures to try to understand and bad blood, and it came to this. But I don't think you need to know all that, but they kind of, like, in just a very few short scenes, like, give you everything you need to know about the emotion and the character so you can understand that.
Yeah. But the backstory is interesting, too.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause they don't exactly say how he got his name, just that it was a joke.
Right.
But
it is evocative, like, Bran and Rickon staring across the moors of Winterfell wondering when their mom would home. And she's like...
Yeah.
You know, we know the truth of it, but, like, it's a pretty horrific image for a mom, like, that they've been taken over. Like, what a scary experience for young boys to have this old family friend, you know, take over the castle and start killing people that you love. And, you know, is our brother's going to come to the rescue? Is our mother going to come to the rescue? Our father's dead? And she's just really going in this, like, little spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds terrible.
Then we go to Talisa, who is teasing one of the Lannister children with rumors they've heard about Rob. These are the two that we heard were captured earlier. Martin, I think.
Martin Lannister.
And somebody else. Martin's the one she's talking to.
Right.
But I don't know their other names. It's a really short scene. They're hearing about Rob eating children, but she says it's only on a full moon, and it's not a full moon tonight, so you're safe.
Right.
Those kinds of things.
Cute kid. Familiar face.
Yeah.
Wonderful,
I've seen
turn
him somewhere.
Wonderful turn up again.
All right. Mance comes upon a whole bunch of frozen horse parts arranged in a rough spiral. Mance believes that the men who rode them are now part of the undead army. And he essentially says that.
Mm-hmm.
He tells Tormund to take John and 20 other good men and climb the wall. He wants them to hit from the other side when he gives a signal. And the signal is going to be the biggest fire the North has ever seen.
The biggest fire the North has ever seen. Yeah, it's that sounds exciting.
Yeah.
And, you know, with this, the showrunners using these opportunities to tell us that the others are not these unthinking, uncultured, like, unintelligent beings, that they have, like, this is a form of communication, and there's some sort of rituals that they're doing, which implies a culture. Which is really cool, and the fact that they're just using the horses because obviously the men are becoming meat for the army.
So that does bring up the question, do you think, along with some kind of culture, that the others might potentially be worshiping something? Is that possible? Like, they're setting up all these sort of ritualistic-looking icons, which a lot of times we associate it with religion and worship of a higher power. Is there a higher power in the other culture, do you think? Especially when you look at, like, one of the things that makes me wonder about this is when I look at what Craster says, you know, about worshiping the real gods.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We think he's talking about the others.
They could just be paying it forward.
Right. He's worshiping their gods.
I think at this point it is an interesting form of speculation, but it's honestly hard to say. That is an enduring question in Game of Thrones. What is, and something that we touch on this book I'm writing, what does it mean to be a real religion in Game of Thrones? What does it mean, like, to what extent are the gods real and they intercede on behalf? Is there intelligence? Is it an elemental force? Is it a god, but he just, you know, but it doesn't really care either way? Is it, like, you know, some sort of technology that can be mastered? I don't know, but, like, it is interesting that it seems like these White Walkers, because in the very first time we met them, they were also doing these weird runes with body parts and stuff. It does seem like there is ritual involved, so they might be harnessing some sort of force and or praying to some gods we don't know about. We just don't know.
Yeah. All right. Do you have anything else to say about this scene?
Just that I think it's interesting watching John, because, you know, Mance is a very smart man. He's making deductions, like, here's 300 people that are now turned into ice zombies. Gior took a big risk, and he's probably, you know, obviously took his best and most experienced people in this big campaign. So now there's 300 of the best Black brothers that are not at Castle Black, and we're going to hit him with this, like, kind of pincher maneuver. And he knows that there's no walls to the south of Castle Black, because that's actually a law, that none of the fortifications on the wall can defend themselves from the south, because there's been Lord Commanders that have gone rogue and turned traitor, and you surely don't want to have to besiege your own castles. So that's one of that they protect the realms of the men, but they themselves are defenseless against those realms. And John knows that, and you can see, like, it in his face, like, how he's being pulled in two directions. And, you know, Mance doesn't make any bones about it. Like, this guy, is he going to prove useful or throw him off the wall?
Yeah. I think Mance is maybe uniquely qualified to lead this raid against the wall.
Right.
Having been Lord Commander himself at one
point. Exactly. He wasn't Lord Commander, but he was certainly...
he wasn't?
No. He was certainly an important... one of the higher-ups of the Rangers.
Okay. Gotcha.
He might have been First Ranger, actually. I'll have to look that up. Maybe the books don't actually say.
All right. So Gior's group arrives back at Craster's Keep, and Craster lets them in. Claims he's doing it because he's a godly man, at least with the gods that matter, anyway.
Like, the White Walkers give a shit about hospitality.
Yeah. White Walker comes knocking, you better let him in. You better. Lest your house be frozen. So he insults Sam, calls him a pig, which I don't know why at this point Sam is just over that. But it drives him outside, where he hears a woman wailing in pain. She's giving birth, which he sort of creepily watches. And unfortunately for her, it's a boy, which we all know what that means in Craster's camp.
Means he's going to be a snack for the White Walkers.
Yep. And or their gods. anything else do you want to say about this scene?
Just that I thought it was really interesting to see, because he kind of threw, he's not glad of the brothers being here. And you can tell that he thinks of, like, telling them to, like, get on before they get spit on. But then he starts... Like, if Tolkien was writing this scene, he would talk about how Craster's eyes fall upon all the fell faces looking at him, and they're thumbing their axes and swords, and he's like, huh, could me and my band of slave women take these guys? Nah. But he still carries himself, and he gets drunk, and he starts provoking these guys, and this is a powder keg ready to go off anyway. And you can tell some of these brothers are looking around and being like, look at this guy, he's living like a king up here, and he's a total piece of shit.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't even be that bad of a guys for ridding the world of him.
No, and I feel like Gior is basically giving him license to do this.
Yeah.
You know, if Gior weren't the kind of guy who refuses to kill Craster,
right,
for, you know, his reasons, then Craster might not be so crass,
right,
in this scene.
But I think he's like, that's the tension that they're setting up this situation. The Craster is not gladly offering this hospitality,
right,
and he's also not being very smart or tactical about the things he says, and can Gior keep control of the situation?
So making good on his word, the mop boy comes back to free Theon, and with some effort, Theon gets onto a horse, and he rides east to where the mop boy says his sister waits for him.
Indeed.
It's a pretty plain scene.
That happened.
Yeah. Let's move on to a more interesting scene. Melisandre is leaving the island on a mission, and Stannis is very reluctant to let her go. He tries to convince her to give him another child before she goes, but she insists that it would kill him. She says that there is another way. Find more king's blood and make sacrifices to the Lord of Light.
Butt sex.
No, that doesn't result in chick. Come on. That's what you do when you don't want children.
But shadow children.
Yeah, who knows how that works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I've seen things pop out of vaginas. I've never seen smoke and shadow and flame.
Who knows what's in her holes?
Who knows, indeed. It's like a clown car up in there, just tons of evil spirits and murderous ghosts, and who knows? We don't know the limits of her powers, and
we don't.
You know, she's very kind of nebulous about it too, and Stannis, he's almost like an addict here.
Yeah.
And the way she treats the way she treats him, and then like when he kind of realizes that she's not having it, and he kind of like staggers back and says, "Oh, your fires are burning low, my lord." I don't know. What is this other way that demands sacrifice?
Yeah, I just can't get over how desperate Stannis seems in this scene. Mm-hmm. You know, he is desperately trying to cling to the one person that still has faith in him.
Right.
When he's lost everyone else.
Right.
And he really plays it up.
Yeah. And you're left to wonder, like, who is the member of Stannis' family that might have some of this royal blood still in them.
Yeah.
We'll have to see.
All right, Danny's introduced to the Walk of Punishment, as they call it, which is a stretch of the walls where slaves are beaten and displayed as warnings to other slaves who might disobey or whatever crime they've committed. It's a warning. Barristan wants to leave now, but Jorah says she needs an army, and this particular army is well-equipped to not get caught up and kill innocents in the fight, which Barristan, I don't know, he's not buying it. He has a more romantic notion of war where people fight for a cause, not because they're bought and paid for.
And Jorah's response, Rhaegar fought valiantly, Rhaegar fought nobly, and Rhaegar died. This is a great balance scene because, like, you know, Barristan's like, you can't use slaves to fight, and you know, Jorah turns right back. It's like, well, how many innocents have you known die in all the battles? And, like, he tells his personal story of, like, the shit show that was the Sack of King's Landing, mm-hmm. where people were raped and murdered and babies' heads were bashed in. It was a really grisly sight. And he's like, you know, the Unsullied won't do that because it's not personal to them.
They'll only kill who you tell them to kill.
And he said there just is a really great line about this is a beast that lives in every man that you unleash when you put a sword in their hand. Mm-hmm. But the Unsullied aren't men. Which I thought was great. And then the, you know, retort's like, well, you know, your brother died. The people died for your brother because they believed in him and loved them, not because they're bought. And, you know, it's good. It's good stuff.
No, I think the sparring between, you know, the triad here has been pretty good. And I've mostly taken Jorah's side on all this because, you know, while he's describing essentially owning a slave army.
Right.
He's also making a lot of good points about you will treat them much better than they're being treated now.
Right.
And you know, add to the fact that they won't go raping and pillaging right. when you send them in to attack your enemies.
Right.
That's a strong argument.
Right.
For buying these Unsullied.
But on the other hand, it's like always the question of like you're lining the pockets and you're perpetuating the system.
Sure.
If you buy that, and like Barristan doesn't have a great counter, or well, we can hire sell swords. Well, they're going to be expensive, and they're going to be fighting for gold. This is not Barristan contradicts himself because like that's like the real plan is like, hey, let's raise our banners, fly, let's ship over to King's Land or not King's Landing, but Westeros, and land somewhere and start building popular support.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not advocating that. He's advocating buying people's loyalty, so it's not great either
with gold that they don't have. I mean, it's yeah.
And I like how Dany's got, like, you know, you kind of got the hint that she's got an idea of her own because, like, Barristan's talking about how I fought beside the last dragon, blah, blah, blah. And she's says, well, I wish I'd known him, but with all due respect, he's not the last dragon.
Right.
And then marches off the screen. Pretty. This is pretty good, Dany. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of good looks from Dany last season, but this is a whole other page to turn.
Yeah. So speaking of Dany, we continue here. Where she goes to the owner of the Unsullied here and says she wants to buy all of them, including the half-trained boys. There's question about whether she can afford it and a lot of insults in the process. Dany offers one of her dragons as payment over both Jorah and Barristan's protests. And she also demands Missandei, and everybody agrees. Dany spells out the future with Dany to her new sidekick, Missandei.
Yeah, it's funny that Jorah and Barristan are both kind of united in opposition to this. Like, you're going to sell a dragon?
Mm-hmm.
Like, one, you know, Aegon forced people to kneel with just one of his. He had three, of course, too. But
yeah,
does seem like a mistake. It does seem like a mistake.
And I like the little touches that they add to this scene. When Barristan objects, Dany kind of doesn't flinch. When Jorah objects, she looks at him in a very disappointed way. You know, because he's her truly trusted advisor.
Right.
He's been with her much longer and through much more with her. Barristan is still the new guy, and Jorah points that out too.
Yeah.
In one of these scenes.
Yeah, there's a bunch of him like trying to throw shade and already, Sir Barristan. Like, come on, Jorah.
But Dany's reaction to, you know, her truly trusted advisor versus her newly trusted advisor, I think, is really good.
Right. But yeah, like the fact that she's willing to sell her biggest dragon, Drogon.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of, did we?
Yeah, what the hell, man?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess you need an army, though. Like, you can't, like, these dragons aren't that big. It's like you're mortgaging the future. I mean, we do that, right? If you have a credit card that doesn't have a zero balance or a car payment, you're doing the same thing. You're mortgaging your future for your present. And that's what that's what she's doing.
She's diversifying her army.
She is.
Right? Like, she, right now she has,
she's
the
dragon
sky
rich,
dominated.
Army poor.
She absolutely is. She needs those ground troops to truly take a city.
Yeah, yeah. Because air superiority means nothing if you can't, like, if you need to occupy,
you can't hold it.
If you need to put,
I've played Axis and Allies.
Yeah,
you can't
hold
a place with a bomber.
Yep. Nope. You can't take territory.
No.
And you have a damn hard time forcing territory to submit. You can bomb them into oblivion. You can torture them. You can glass their castles. But then you're going to preside over a graveyard and not a country.
Yeah.
It's great. Did we get into the talk she had with Missandei?
A little bit. She's just kind of talking about, you know, what it's like to be a slave, the future with her.
I did like
stuff.
Daenerys' little Corleone moment where she's like, never go against a family in front of strangers, to Jorah and Barristan.
Yeah. That is good.
And then astute watchers will notice that when Missandei quoted High Valyrian, Valar Morghulis, Dany did not need a translator.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Okay.
But yeah, and that's the other thing, is she asked, like, you know, why did the slave say, let me die? And Missandei says, because there's no masters in the grave, which that's incredibly sad and dark.
Mm-hmm.
And she's getting the rules of the Unsullied, like, if you purchase them, that they are yours, and they'll obey, and that's all they do. And she also gut checks Missandei, like, hey, do you understand what it means to be in my service? It'd be interesting to see what if Missandei be like, you know what, I really kind of want to go back to Narth. I do have family that I want to return
right.
to.
You bought my freedom, not my service, right?
Right. And then there's also, like, she checked Barristan with, I'm not the last dragon, when Missandei pulls the all men must die, she's like, we are not men.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Crucial. All right, Tyrion's given the royal ledgers at Littlefinger's brothel. Littlefinger, in the process, thanks Tyrion for sorting out the misunderstanding over Roz being his secret whore lover, and says he owes him a debt. Tyrion also owes a debt to Pod, which he decides to repay with a complimentary session with several of Littlefinger's whores.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what's going through the actor who plays Pod's head. Like, the look on his face, I don't even know if they had him act for that scene.
Right. Yeah,
just,
no.
Like, being surrounded by all these incredibly beautiful naked women, and, like, The idea that he's never been with a woman before.
Right. And one of these women are like Spider-Woman.
And then on the way out, Bronn's like, pace yourself.
Yeah, no shit. No shit.
It's so good.
It is pretty. It's pretty funny. And there's also, he gets all these ledgers, and there's this big, and, you know, Bronn's kind of poking fun of him about it being dull reading. And Tyrion's like, no, this is the secret history of the Seven Kingdoms. And then Bronn comes back with, unless Lord Twatbeard made it all up, which turns out he did. But I also, like, I've forgotten that Littlefinger, Lord Twatbeard. I'm surprised that didn't stick. That's a pretty good, he does got a little merkin mouth going on.
Sure. Yeah.
There's also a really funny, like, in-universe or out-of-universe kind of meta thing about the one, only one woman out of, or the only one, one of the four women in the world that can perform the Miranese knot, which is how George Martin described his situation, why it took so long to get Feast and Dance out, because he had this this plot tied up in this town, the city of Marine, and he is like a Gordian knot, and he couldn't figure out how to slice it. So it's kind of like, it's funny too, because now apparently George has got another Miranese knot that he's been working on for longer than ever, trying to get winds out, and it's kind of, it feels a little mean-spirited at this point, but this was back in the heyday where everyone thought George would have the books finished and he'd keep pace, and like once Dance came out, all the others will come easy, and ha ha ha, it's not so not so funny now.
No, I thought it was a good nod, though.
Good, yeah. Good wink to the meta commentary and the fans.
So a little time passes here. The scene kind of continues, and Tyrion's examining the books. He finds out that Littlefinger has been borrowing money they can't afford to pay back from his father, but that's not the money he's worried about. He's worried about the stuff coming from the Iron Bank of Braavos. Much scarier than
his
father.
It's not the cute and cuddly bank.
No.
It's not the Citizens Bank. It's the Iron Bank, yeah.
But that conversation is interrupted when Pod returns, and he hands Tyrion back the money that he spent on the whores, claiming that the ladies refused payment after the incredible things he did to them. This is classic. This is a classic Game of Thrones
scene. And they don't need, like, and we hear that they're going to, like, he's like, sit down, Podrick, we need details, which is funny, but the funny thing is like, this, they don't explain it.
No.
It's like you're just left to imagine what Pod the Rod was able to do to these.
Right.
Like, and these are not like your garden variety sex worker. These were like the A-team.
Yeah.
The
most experienced workers in Littlefinger's stable.
Yeah. And then like either he's blessed with natural talent and ability, or he's got, I don't know, like a Hitachi magic wand for a dick.
He's well endowed, I assume.
It is, but is that fun? Like, you know, if he's got a 12-inch yanger, is that what women want?
I've been
led to believe that's at best an acquired taste.
This is why it's such a good scene, because they don't answer those questions.
Yeah, you just left to understand, like, how does virginal doofus...
It's building Pod as a legend.
Yeah.
I mean, this is...
Yeah.
He's becoming a legend in Westeros at this point.
Right.
Certainly amongst these couple nobles who... You know, hear the stories.
Yeah, no, apparently. it's pretty funny. Like I said, this is an unusually funny Game of Thrones episode.
It does make me wonder, because Littlefinger talks about the debt that he owes Tyrion, and I think this is a pretty small way to pay back that debt. But could it be that Littlefinger told them to refuse the money? Could
it be
something much more mundane to pay Tyrion back?
It would be funny if Littlefinger just kind of did that as a joke, a private joke to himself.
Oh yeah, like to make Pod look like.
Yeah. Like, because we know that, like, Tyrion is a very carnal creature, and he's very sensual, and the fact that his, like, squire could outdo him in the bedpost notching might stick
on his first try.
Right.
On his first try.
Right. Beginner's fuck.
All right, we move on to Theon being chased by his captors. He rides into the woods where he's knocked off his horse. The men begin to rape him, but they're stopped by the mop boy's arrows, and he helps Theon up, and they head off.
So much attempted rape in this episode.
There's a lot of it, yeah.
And these are a pack of brute fuckers. You know how I know? One guy's got a mace or a Morningstar. Every time I see it, I'm like, you're just a brute fucker. Like,
you just want to hurt people.
Yeah. Like, and Bobby B's up there, too, with his Warhammer. Like, if you're just crushing people... If you're inflicting blunt force trauma to them,
The blow that Theon takes is vicious. And a mace hit hard enough to knock you off your horse.
Right in the ribs, and then like when the guy steps on you, can kind of hear his crawl. Like, I feel like he's got several broken ribs, and this has just got to be unbelievably painful, and then they're going to rape him, and oh my God. Thank God his benefactor shows up and saves him.
Yeah, mop boy.
Mop boy to the rescue again.
And I don't know where they're heading off to, because we don't get back to that, but I assume to his sister still. As Jaime warned Brienne, speaking of rape, the men come to rape her that night. Jaime uses his silver tongue to convince the leader of the men that the sapphires her family would give for her are worth keeping her honor unbesmirched. That's his choice of words, not mine. I'm not the fancy lad here. Mm-hmm. He's the fancy lad.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie presses his luck and tries to convince the man that he should take him back to Tywin instead of Rob and be rewarded with gold. The man releases him from his restraints and takes him to a table where everything seems to be going well until the man pins him against it and chops his hand off.
Yeah, says, you're nothing without your daddy. Here's something to help you remember. Chop. And it's just so quick and sudden. You think the danger's over, and then that, and then Smash to Black and Bear and the Maiden Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting book detail. This character, who is not the same character that does the cutting of Jaime, his name's Vargo Hoat, and he's got a lisp. So there's like some high comedy here as Jamie's trying to do this negotiation, and this guy is saying sapphires like this, you know. See, he's worth how many sapphires? Like,
it's like a Princess Bride kind of
thing. Yeah, Daffy Duck. It's kind of funny, but in a very broad kind of like, is this appropriate? Like, we're doing rape negotiations, and this guy's doing Sylvester the Cat. What's going on here? So I'm kind of glad. Like, in most cases, I think the Double D's did a very good job, Dan and David, in like decolorizing a little bit of Martin, because he gets pretty crazy and like he even self describes he liked to take real world details, like if it was like turn the colors up to 11, turn this and there's an excess of colorful personality sometimes, and if you put that on screen, can you imagine the scene if this guy suffering fuckataff.
No.
Are you saying?
No.
I've never laid with a woman that size. You know, like right. It would be wildly inappropriate.
It would be. It absolutely would be. Although hilarious, I'm sure.
Yeah.
In a certain dark kind of way. But
and here's the thing. Jamie, smug as fuck, does not see any bit of danger in here. He just, and that's like what this guy says. Like, you. This has always worked. Anytime, like, you've never been in trouble, you've never been afraid for your life, and if you ever have, all you gotta say is my father, and then bam, you'd be ransomed, you'd be bailed out of it, and some situations, you know, just some pits you can't talk your ass out of, and this is one of them. Shlop, and your arm's gone.
Yeah, and I feel like it comes down to Jamie not understanding the North very well. These people aren't driven by the same motives as they are down south.
Yeah, they have a bit of a massive chip on their shoulder and an inferiority complex. And you would be well not to talk down to them and remind them of that when you're trying to. I mean, he's just not. Yeah, he's acting like this guy's Janna Slint, and he's not.
Yep. And that's the end of the episode. Like you said, we smash cut to that Bear and the Maiden Fair punk cover.
I do like it. This version in the end of the credits is made by a band called The Hold Steady. I was fortunate to see the Manimals, which is a Game of Thrones. They're a rock band, but they did this seven concept album, and they were invited to the previous year's Con of Thrones to do a concert, and they do a really righteous version of this. I'm going to include the link to the video of it. But if you ever get a chance to go to a fan con, or if they're ever in your area, you should check out the Manimals if you're a Game of Thrones fan, because it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Jamie Glamister sends his regards.
Right.
You know what I say about the vicious fuckers coming at you with morning stars and maces. They're the break bones.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when two vicious fuckers come at you with clubs? Because we got them. Club.baldmove.com. Going to beat you over the head with it.
I see what you did there.
Until you sign up, because it's the way, like, you know, there's a 0.0% chance that we would be doing a Game of Thrones rewatch if we weren't doing this full time. The reason we're able to do this full time is because enough of our listeners see value in what we produce to kick in a little bit to keep things going. And you can join that army, that club wielding vicious fucker of an army of Bald Move Club members by going to club.baldmove.com and signing up. And you get a lot of cool stuff. First, a club. Every club member is issued a club. A virtual club.
Digital club.
That may or may not break bones
and
inflict blunt force trauma. You get VIP access to the forums. You get ad-free feeds. You get video feeds of most of our podcasts. You get first-run Bald Movies, full spoiler, fully leaded spoiler edition. You get quips. You get Lunch with Jim and Aaron's. You're like, what the hell is a quip? What the hell is a Lunch with Jim and Aaron? Well, hey, you go to club.baldmove.com. You can sample all that content free, gratis, no charge. You can try the whole club 30 days risk-free. just by going and signing up. Club.baldmove.com.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
That's it. Do we have some feedback to do?
We do. We have a little bit of feedback. As I said last episode, this is going to be a thin mailbag because we're essentially recording this the day after we recorded the last one. There hasn't been a lot of time for the feedback bag to swell. But that just means there'll probably be a super long feedback for the week after. The reason we're doing recording it kind of out of sequence is because we're going to be away at a podcast conference next week. So we're trying to get, you know, that means we pack everything into the week before. Without further ado, Mark S. with our first, and I think only, non-spoiler email. You talked last episode about the first time we hear the Reigns of Castamere during your Season 3, Episode 2 podcast. The first time we actually hear the song is when Tyrion arrives in Joffrey's name day tournament in the first episode of Season 2. You can hear him whistling the tune. The Double D's mention it during the episode commentary. They said they told composer Ramin Djawadi? Or is it Ramin? Yeah, it's Ramin, right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, Djawadi. To write the catchiest tune he could, or something along those lines. We also hear Bronn singing during... I didn't remember that, but I do remember this in retrospect. We also hear Bronn singing During the episode Blackwater at the end of season two, but I'm not sure if that's the first time we hear the actual words. That's where he was, you know, he gets confronted by the Lannister soldiers and then in the eve before the battle. But yeah, I'd totally forgotten about the Tyrion one, and I'd also low-key forgot the one with Bronn. So thanks for setting us straight on that. That is all of the non-spoiler feedback we have. We have a little bit of spoiler feedback to consider here. If you'd like to send us some, please do so. GameofThrones@baldmove.com, or I start a thread for spoilers in the forum each week. You can find that on the Game of Thrones section or forums, forums.baldmove.com. And if you want to start a non-spoiler, feel free to do so. It's easy. Just click on the link at the top. It says new top, and boom, and you're on your way. I just feel like it'd be a wasted effort and a lot of zero reply threads.
Yeah.
So, anyway, with that said, on to the spoilers.
Okay, I got something to talk about right off the bat.
Okay.
Hashtag not my Martin. Martin Lannister. No, I recognize Tommen Lannister when I see him. Can you...
Tommen Baratheon, please. Excuse me.
Okay, fair. How does a young actor land this gig where he plays one character and then... He doesn't reprise his role later, although he does. He's in another scene as Martin. Mm-hmm. But he also comes back as Tommen.
It's ballsy. It's
like, can
ballsy
you imagine
to because he looked, and it's not like he's like massively changed.
No.
He's dyed his hair different. He's just...
Like, if they hired Aidan Gillian to come back as,
right.
like, Littlefinger's cousin Middlefinger, right? Like, well, people would notice,
right.
and people would be like, what would this... I don't understand this.
I mean, I will say that he is a pretty minor character, and there was a... No, he just comes back next season. Like, as soon
yeah.
as Joffrey's dead,
mm-hmm.
he's, like, front and center, and Margaery's trying to sleep with him, and it is ballsy. Like, this show's done a lot of recasting, particularly with, you know, The Mountain.
Right, but that's different people playing the same character.
They do. They recast Beric Dondarrion. We're about to see something like that. But, yeah, like, taking a person and then just recasting them for a pretty major role and not doing anything about... Yeah, it's
And I know people are
going to
be
jarring.
Like, oh, well, they're the same family. Of course they would look alike. They look
not,
identical.
Yeah, because they're the same person. And that's
yeah.
the thing, like... I didn't notice it and it bothered me the first time, but like when this kid shows up, it's like, well, that's fucking Tommen Lannister.
Yeah.
Or Tommen Baratheon. I just fucking did it again. Yeah. By God, that's Tommen's music as he comes in. I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do we count these as Theon torture scenes? I think for
probably.
Sure the mace to the chest, attempted rape, and that's, I mean, they are psychological torment. There's two scenes.
Yes.
I'm gonna say that there's one scene of torture, which would bring us up to a torture count of three.
Okay.
Because yeah, that's torture by in you know. There's also, I like that little cheeky line where, because Ramsay's is murdering his own men. Like, I don't know that they were in on this part of the joke.
They weren't. No. I mean, when the guy says,
well,
you little bastard.
When he says, you
yeah.
little bastard, and that's like a clue to the book readers that, well, it's not even a clue. It's funny because it feels like the double D's kind of encouraged the culture that we got where there was the book readers going, he, watching
yeah.
the, because they're doing it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that to Ramsay, the bastard of the Dreadfort. Is pretty cheeky. But yeah, I'm definitely, I think you could arguably say this is because him freeing Theon just to recapture him is also torture. You can say it's four torture scenes, but to play it safe and just to be as, you know, neutral as possible, I'm going to only say it was one in this episode. But we're still out
Can
of-
we just go like forms of torture? Like individual instances of... Or
oh,
applications of torture,
but that's what I'm
like
saying.
The
would,
foot screw and the...
But would freeing Theon be a form of torture? I would say yes.
Yeah.
Because it's in service of, you know...
That's what I mean, yeah. Like, count this as the incident where he let him go and then...
But then staging
yeah.
a false rape and then staging, like, the... You
and
know, and not staging, but
the,
breaking
the dog
his ribs.
Hunting
and
like,
yeah,
all
yeah,
that
yeah.
stuff, yeah.
No, and it's especially insidious because... Theon is so incredibly thankful to this
yeah.
guy for doing it. And he's got, obviously, like, these super warm feelings. Like, this is his savior. This guy's his own personal Jesus Christ.
Ramsay is fuck.
He really is.
Ramsay
he really is,
a is fuck, man.
He really is. And this AMA I did on Reddit for the book this week, someone asked me, like, who's the worst villain, Pete Campbell or Ramsay? It's funny. It's a funny question.
Right.
And it's also, it goes back to, you know, like our long and storied coverage of Mad Men. But like, Ramsay is one of the most evil characters, period.
Yeah.
He's just a really terrible, terrible individual and human being. That's all the stuff I had to talk about as far as forward looking.
Yeah, I don't have much either.
Yeah. I mean, like, I could go on and on about Jamie and Brienne, but like, that's, I'll just let the story, I'll let the story unfold. Carrie W, first of our non, or our spoiler emails, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. Pumped about the rewatch. You were mentioning last week about your favorite season. I agreed with your sentiments about season four. My husband and I have all long debates about our Game of Thrones number, which is a ranker of the seasons. I'm a 6-4-3-1-7-2-5. He puts season three on top with a 3-6-4-2-1-7-5. What would your and Jim's Game of Thrones number be? I feel like we're going to be asked this question until we fucking do it. So maybe we should fucking do it.
Can we do it for next week? Can we come up with a number for next week? Because I'm really going to have to like think about what happens when and how,
I mean,
that all
can
factors into my score.
I'd just rather get ripped the Band-Aid off here.
On the fly, I know I'm going to come up with a number I'm not satisfied with.
Okay.
In the future.
Well, then, yes, so we need to. Maybe that's something we can do in the plane ride. We need to come up with a. We will unveil. We will unveil our Game of Thrones number on next week's podcast.
Okay.
I have a feeling that this is pretty solid because five is definitely, I think, the worst. It's one of those things that same way, like when I was ranking Mad Men seasons, like when you see season one as the third best, like that seems wrong, but that's the problem. Like all these seasons are so good. You just really like for the first five episodes, there's just a frog's hair difference between them. And then you get to like seven and five and there's a pretty big drop off between those two.
Sure.
So it's like if you had a deep, if you had a pool and it like was like 1 foot deep, 3 foot deep, and then 8 foot deep, 8 foot one, 8 foot two, 8 foot three, 8 foot four. It's like if you're in the deep end, you're good. You know, it's pretty damn deep over there. Let's move on to Sean McGee. You discussed what it'd been like if Ned asked Bobby B to legitimize John. I think maybe the major reason it didn't happen is that it would maybe disinherit Rob. Legitimizing the progeny of an affair typically would only affect long-term pecking order, but are we sure which one was born first? I did some research on this because I thought it was no question that Rob was born first.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently there's some disagreement because Rob was, you know, Ned got Kat pregnant like 2 weeks before he went off to war. So how in the world could anything? But I guess there's some arguments we made. You don't know, like, you know, women's, their gestation periods could be like 5 to 6 weeks longer or shorter.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some wiggle room there. I don't think if you go with the fiction of Ned riding to war, like maybe he got a woman pregnant in the first 4 or 5 weeks of the campaign, and maybe there's a question. But in reality, we know that John's not even Ned's kid, and he's certainly younger. And I also feel like when I was doing the research, it seemed like the consensus also was no matter what it is, it would be a pretty simple matter to just have the king decree that the birth date was whatever Ned wanted to be, because
sure,
who's going to contradict them?
Yeah,
it's a royal decree. You're already legitimizing a bastard. Just go ahead and make sure his birthday. Now the problem would be then what happens if Rob dies?
Sure.
Now you've got your illegitimate, you got your legitimized son taking over, and like that would send Kat into like fucking, I don't know, apocalyptic fit.
Mm-hmm.
Her skull would explode. But you know, maybe Rob never dies. I still think, I know it's a fun mental game, which would play more havoc in the realm if you legitimized him or if it just played out the way it did. Aaron P says, wondering if you read this, and he links to a Vox article from September of last year where they're talking about the impossibility of making a Game of Thrones finale that pleases everybody. The too long didn't read version of this is the author's premise is because Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire appeals, results from managing to simultaneously be one, high fantasy, two, at the same time, a subversion of high fantasy, and three, compelling historical fiction all at once, the ending cannot be able to satisfy everyone because neither Gurm nor the Double D's can make an ending that checks off all three of those requirements. Before we talk about it, I want to let Aaron develop his thoughts here. I personally agree with the premise, but not the conclusion. While the TV show may or may not be headed for a very high standard of high fantasy ending, or a standard high fantasy ending, odds are Gurm has something else in mind, and if Gurm communicated that to Double D's, the show will probably have a similar, if not the same, ending. There's also several possible endings based on historical precedent, any one of which could cover at least a historical and subversion of high fantasy. Some of the most popular possibilities hinted at the historical basis for Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire, and further hinted at in various ways, especially by The World of Ice and Fire, would be a transition to a type of aristocratic republic where the king and queen are elected by other nobles, paralleling the Magna Carta, House of Lords, etc. A likely candidate for this would be someone who is, by marriage or birth, blends the rival factions together, a la the end of the War of the Roses. The most popular version of this being Sansa and Tyrion marriage ending up being re-legitimized, and them and their offspring sitting on the Iron Throne. Folks, this is the always interesting historical analysis of Game of Thrones Academy over at YouTube are proponents of this type of ending. It seems perfectly possible still to have a fantasy ending, i.e. White Walker's defeated or a peace is renewed with them. While subverting that ending, all or most of the good guys die, particularly Dany and Jon, and historical ending, Cersei defeated and replaced by electoral means of some sort. Seems like there could be several variation of similar endings that would work too. Jim, what do you think?
I mean, I think the thing that's most at odds here is the high fantasy versus subverting the high fantasy. Those seem to be the two that are in conflict. That historical fiction, I think they can get away with making that satisfying for the people who are into it, whichever way they go, as long as it's, you know, somewhat accurate to how the War of the Roses ended.
Right.
The others, I don't know. Is it a high fantasy ending to have the White Walkers defeated, but all of your heroes dead?
No. I mean, certainly the ending is the rightful king is restored and there's a big coronation and he marries the princess and it's.
I mean, it's a Star Wars throne room, right? It's
Aragorn marrying
if you don't have Arwen. That celebration at the end,
right?
That's not the high fantasy you want. Like,
right.
I struggle to see how it could be both things.
I disagree with the premise because Game of Thrones is high fantasy that subverts high fantasy. It's a subversion of high fantasy. Like, that's like trying to fit it into two molds.
But I guess they're saying, like, what people watch it for. Hmm. Like, do some people watch this as high fantasy?
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Like, no, I don't, because it's a subversion of such. Because if it's high fantasy, Ned probably wouldn't have beheaded. Jaime's arm wouldn't have been chopped off. You know,
that's true.
There wouldn't be all this rape and torture and all this other crazy shit. Or if it would, it would be all done by unambiguously evil characters with unknowable and understandable motivations, which is already kind of like happening with the White Walkers. I think it's what attracts people is the subversion.
I mean, certainly that's what attracted me to it.
Yeah.
Is that it wasn't high fantasy.
So I think, like, that's why I've always said, like, people that are really obsessing over who can sit on the Iron Throne, especially the people that want to throw who's got the strongest, like, claim, like, what's the, like, that's silly. Like, that's not, you know, I've long been a proponent of, like, some form of democratic rule taking over. And I feel like, especially with season 7, that the Double D's at least are on my side. And I also don't have a lot of sympathy for the people that say, well, that's, you know, ahistorical, because the Greeks were fucking with democracy a long time before the Middle Ages. And in the Game of Thrones universe, as Tyrion said, you know, the Night's Watch democratically elects its leaders. Over in the free city of Volantis, they democratically elect their leaders. The Valyrian Freehold had like the power sharing where like the powerful nobles would elect one of them to lead them. There's a lot of precedent for this. Like, it's not going to be like one man, one vote.
Right. It's more kinda of that aristocratic republic that he's talking about.
Yeah.
You know, the powerful people or the landowners in the Romans case, like those people are voting on who becomes.
Right. Or it's some sort of like, you know, like
the leader.
It's the beginning of a House of Lords or something like that. It's not going to be a full on, but it's going to be a recognizable step in that direction. away from the, like, well, you came out of the right womb and had the right father squirt a seed up into said womb, so you're the new king, and it'll be like that forever and ever and ever.
And that certainly, yeah, plays right into the concept of subverting the high fantasy.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess if you're saying that the premise is invalid because people don't watch this for high fantasy, maybe they don't have a problem.
Right, like imagine at the end of Lord of the Rings, if Aragorn had said, I'm stepping aside and I'm letting the people of the White City elect their stewards from here on. That would be a subversion of high fantasy.
And... No, I think ultimately, like, if they're faithful to what Game of Thrones has been up to now, people will be satisfied, you know, because they're watching for a reason.
Yeah.
And I think the reasons are Game of Thrones is what Game of Thrones is.
Right.
And if you want to label it a subversion of high fantasy, that's fine. If you want to label it historical fiction, that's fine. But just give people the ending that suits the show you've created up till now.
Exactly.
And I think most people, if not all of them, will be satisfied with that.
Because you'll never, I mean, the highest you've ever going to get is like 80-85%. Because some people are, you can't please everybody. Plus, there's also the... There's always like a, you know, like a bittersweet to anything ending, even if it ends well, because there's going to be no more. Like,
yeah,
you know, a Breaking Bad gave you like a choose your own. Which ending do you want? We'll give you three. We'll give you Walt triumphant. We'll give you Walt abased, and we'll give you kind of like a crowd a fan service ending. Mm-hmm. And people still weren't entirely happy. And I remember being a little bit bummed because there's not going to be more Breaking Bad. So like, there's the melancholy of like, we're leaving this world and we're never coming back. I know there's a prequel stuff planned and Age of Heroes and all that, but we're not coming back to these characters and these situations again. And that's going to add some melancholy, even if it's best. And I think that we're probably headed for a divisive one, because there's also going to be a bunch of book purists that are going to shit on it no matter what, because it's not George's story. I think that if 2/3 of the fan base embrace the ending of the Game of Thrones series, the Double D's will have pulled off something special.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any way 90% of fans are going to be on board with it. I just don't. It's
already so divisive.
Right. Yeah. Because there's going to be at least 20% of the people that are just going to be irate because of the way, you know, the fact that George couldn't tell his story first.
Right.
And you're just, you know, and that's not an invalid approach to the material either. Anything else you want to say, or should we move on?
Let's move on.
Lydia L. While discussing the coverage of 701 during your discussion of a listener's theory that Sansa and Pod would make a good match, I remembered a book plot point that was excluded from the show but could possibly be played out by another character in the style of Roose transforming to Tywin and Harrenhal. In order to solidify the alliance between the Wildlings and the Northern Lords under Jon as Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, he arranges a marriage between the Magnar of Thyn and Alys Karstark. Due to the fact that Alys's arrival at Castle Black was misinterpreted in the fires by Melisandre to be Arya, I wonder if one of Jon's actual sisters will be given to a Wilding husband to unite the entire North to pacify civil discontent in light of a greater threat. I'm curious to know what you think. So her theory is that, I don't know, Sansa could be married to someone like Tormund to kind of bring the Wildlings back into the fold of the realms of men.
Yeah.
I don't know that you need to do that. I think that there's a vast amount of the North that's unsettled and unpopulated, and you could just let the Wildlings live there, and you wouldn't need to give them lands and titles right away. Maybe you do, and that's the other thing, is like, maybe just by right of, you know, conquest and assisting of the realm, that why wouldn't you just give Tormund a castle anyway?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's several northern lords and castles that, like, they make that a point of in the last season. Like, there's a bunch of them open. Why not give a few out?
Yeah, I wonder if that kind of thing, you know, some kind of symbolic marriage alliance would really please the Wildlings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they're all
they
about,
don't really care about,
yeah,
that
about
stuff.
Their own personal freedom, essentially. Maybe giving them their own lands and not tying them to a northern house, but saying you can have some of our lands to do with as you please.
Right. Maybe you can establish an independent freehold of the Wildlings.
Yeah.
Like in the Gift, which is the wide stretch of land between the wall and some arbitrary point that an ancient Stark gave the Night's Watch. You could let them settle there.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't be taking anybody's land except for potentially the Night's Watch, but they're so small. And the other thing is the wall's been knocked down at this point. Is the Night's Watch going to be going forward? If the wall's gone, the White Walkers are utterly vanquished, there's a shit ton of land that you could give the wildlings. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is on the show, okay, are the fans going to be on board with Arya marrying anyone? I say no.
Probably not.
And that seems like an utter betrayal of her character. Mm-hmm. And there's not enough time for me to plausibly believe that she would fall in love with anybody but maybe Gendry. But even then, they're more brother and sister. That'd be feel kind of gross. And Sansa, like, the only wildling that's remotely large enough in her eyes to make that plausible is Tormund, and if anything, he's gunning for Brienne.
Yeah.
And he's not going to be interested in Sansa, and Sansa's certainly not going to be interested in him. So there's nothing wrong with your theory. I just don't think it's going to be super popular with fans, and I don't feel like there's enough time to introduce a new character to make it work, and the existing characters, just the chemistry is all off.
Okay.
So yeah. That is the final email we have. Again, it's a little short, but we'll be back with to consider more next week when we consider episode, what are we on, 304 now?
Yeah.
Wow, we're just buzzing right through this thing.
Oh, almost halfway.
Thanks for all the participation. Thanks for everybody downloading the podcast and listening to it in off season. Really been pleased with the level of participation and how many people are enjoying it. We'll see you next week for the next episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.